Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Derek Walcott, giant of Caribbean and American poetry, died last week at 87. He was old school in many ways, the Caribbean islander who adored the classics, Homer, Shakespeare, but also the playwright and poet who wrestled with the legacy of colonialism and imperialism in the West Indies, the Nobel Prize winner who eloquently tried to reconcile the different cultures he loved. He's been celebrated for days now, and still we can't get enough of his verse. This hour on Point, the poetry of Derek Walcott. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you revisited Walcott's work in the days since his death? What poems, what lines speak to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Osgood Melnichuk, a novelist, essayist, poet, associate professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He knew Derek Walcott very well, worked with him during their time at Boston University. Osgood Melnichuk, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Great to be here, Tom.
And with us from Pittsburgh is Adriana Ramirez, faculty member in the nonfiction writing program at Carlo University. She's also a critic at large for the Los Angeles Times. You can read her LA Times piece, Derek Walcott's Poetry Had Grandeur and Exuberance of Language, at our website, onpointradio.org. Adriana Ramirez, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
He's a playwright as well. We know that. He wrote essays. We know that. He had a big life, and we know all that. We want to hear poetry in this hour. He caught so many people with his verse. And here's just, let's kick right off. I want a lot of poetry here. Here's actor Tom Hiddleston. You may have heard a little bit of this. But here it is in full, reading Derek Walcott's poem, Love After Love, which the actor, Hiddleston, posted on his Facebook page back in 2012.
The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life.
Actor Tom Hiddleston reading Derek Walcott's poem, Love After Love. Adriana Ramirez, just jump in right there, if you would. What do we hear already in the poetry of this remarkable man?
Oh, well, there's certainly a lot of drama. I mean, I think Hiddleston's reading really brings out the drama of the line breaks and the grandiosity of the verse, certainly.
But this invitation, Osgood, this to come back and meet yourself again, almost as if for the first time or the first time in a long time, and be generous, be at peace, be
sure.
Resolved.
Sure. I think you see right away one of the central themes in Derek's work, and that is a kind of confrontation with the self and the way that he escapes from the labyrinth of the self. In that poem, he's really kind of just alone with the alone.
Yeah.
And yet what he had, what was part of his genius, was the ability to escape from the labyrinth of the self by entering the labyrinth of the world. And what you don't hear in that poem, and what makes that poem a little bit unusual, is its starkness. And the sort of the self-critical voice was always there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you also had entering into his poetry from the start and then evolving over the years was an ability to discover redemption in the natural world. He's very much a poet who found a way to be much larger than any kind of narrow or small self. He contained multitudes.
Adriana.
If I may add to that, I think that in finding himself in the larger world, it also reflects the kind of individual nature, right? There's something about the big and universal that reflects back on the self. And I think that in addition to the darkness in that poem, there's also a joy and a joy at discovery. And I really love how he's able to balance those two facets and how something can be both, you know, dark and joyous at the same time. And that contradiction remains there.
I mean, it's one of those things like the Serenity Prayer that I know people who have had that. We've been hearing from the listeners today who've had that pinned to their fridge for decades. You wrote it in 1971.
Right.
There's a kind of compassion for oneself, himself, ourselves in that poem, Adriana.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the end, you know, when it's calling for a feast, right? There's something kind of lovely of the idea that you can feast upon yourself and you can consume yourself, even though, you know, you probably know yourself best of all.
Let's hear more poetry right away. Here, this is a little bit. It was recorded in 2015, the New Yorker Poetry Podcast, and poet Major Jackson reads just the second verse of Derek Walcott's In Italy. It evokes images that sound more like Walcott's native St. Lucia than the canals of Venice or the towering cathedrals and Renaissance frescoes of Rome. But here, from In Italy.
The blue windows, the lemon-colored counterpane, the knowing that the sea is behind the avenue with balconies and bicycles, that the gelid traffic mixes its fumes with coffee, transient interiors, transient bedsheets, and the transient view of sea-salted hotels with spiky palms, in spite of which summer is serious, since there is inevitably a farewell to arms, to the storm-haired beauty who will disappear. The shifted absence of your axes, love wobbles on your body's pivot to the carriage's shudder as it glides past the roofs and beaches of the Ligurian coast. Things lose their balance and totter from the small blows of memory. You wait for revelations, for leaping dolphins, for nightingales to loosen their knotted throats, for the bell in the tower to absolve your sins, like the furled sails of the homecoming boats.
Poet Major Jackson reading from Derek Walcott's In Italy, written in 2008. I mean, Adriana, you wrote for the LA Times about the grandeur and exuberance. Here we've got leaping dolphins and nightingales loosening their knotted throats and revelations. It's all boring out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the smell of coffee, love wobbling, all these kinds of this use of language definitely harkens to a joy in the image. And, you know, he was a painter and you can definitely see his painterly eye as he's looking at these objects. And one of the things that I love about this poem is that it takes a place like Italy that we, you know, already is kind of centralized in the European imagination, and it makes it seem foreign, exotic. You know, I love the idea of a Caribbean writer going to Europe and writing about it in a kind of colonial travel writer way. It's kind of lovely.
This sea-salted hotels and spiky palms, and pretty soon it's like a Somerset Maugham reverse flip here. Him coming back from the islands and talking about the old country. Askold, for listeners who don't know or haven't, give us just the heart of his biography. He's out of St. Lucia, just south of Martinique in the West Indies.
And he's publishing his first poems very early in local newspapers, I think at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. And then when he's 17, he publishes a chapbook with help from his mother. He then organizes a theater troupe, which eventually becomes the Trinidad Theater Workshop. And then he gets a grant to come to New York City, where he, as I recall, meets a lot of great American writers, including Arthur Miller in the 50s, and then kind of moves back and forth between St. Lucia, Trinidad, and New York through the 60s and 70s, and then in the early 80s winds up teaching at Boston University, which is where I got to know him.
Championed by American poets. Robert Lowell was a huge champion of him very
Absolutely.
Early on.
Well, and even before that, his first book was championed by Robert Graves, the great British poet, about whom Derek always spoke really fondly about Graves' poems and Graves' book of mythology called The White Goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Adriana, throughout, I mean, he ends up being a man of more than one home. He's rooted in that St. Lucia, that Caribbean experience, but spends decades in the United States and beyond, and always kind of straddling or working to align or make sense of this meeting, these two what realms?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of things. You know, he was very good friends with Seamus Heaney and with Joseph Brodsky, who were also poets in exile, working in the Boston area. And I think it says something that, you know, he chose friends who were poets who were working with the same themes of leaving their country mm-hmm. and of finding themselves in America.
From Ireland, from Poland in their case.
Russia. Yeah.
Russia. Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, in Ireland. And, you know, so I think that's really neat. And I also think, you know, he found his island everywhere he went. And it was a way of entering into the larger tradition. You know, there were some wonderful quotes and interviews for him where he calls himself an heir to Milton. And I think that there's something really lovely about, again, decentralizing from Europe and taking that to the Caribbean. And it's such an epic place. And I love that it lends itself to the kind of grandiose descriptions that Walcott employed. So I think everywhere he went, he found a little bit of his island. And, you know, as an immigrant writer, I can certainly relate to that and understand what it is to have your homeland calling to you and trying to define yourself in a country that is so foreign and different from that.
You said poetry tends to be soft jazz. Derek Walcott was calypso, Adriana.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we expect a certain softness from our poetry or certain meditation or a certain confessional nature, whereas I feel like Walcott's poetry, the inherent loudness and the drama of it kind of demands a different kind of listening.
We're going to hear a lot more in this hour. Adriana Ramirez, please stand by there in Pittsburgh. It's so great to have you. And Oskold Melnichuk with me in the studio today. We're talking about the poetry of Derek Walcott. What have you heard in all the celebration and memorializing of Derek Walcott in his poetry? In the 1990s, he and Paul Simon collaborated on the musical The Cape Man about the life of murderer Salvador Agron. In this song, Born in Puerto Rico, sings about his arrival in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I was born in Puerto Rico and my blood is Taino, Spanish Caribbean, my soul.
Came here wearing summer clothes and winter, hearts of sunshine in the cold.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry of Derek Walcott, a poetry of grandeur and exuberance from the Caribbean master who died last week at 87. Oskold Melnichuk joins us. He worked alongside Derek Walcott for years at Boston University, novelist, essayist, poet, now at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Adriana Ramirez is with us from Carlo University, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She's written compellingly about Derek Walcott in the last few days. You can join us this hour as well. Do you know this poetry? Have you luxuriated in the tactile splendor of it? Verse crisp as sand, clear as sunlight, he wrote. And do you see Walcott as a hero of language, a hero of anti-colonialism? Do you see him as torn between cultures, between, as he wrote, this Africa and this English tongue I love? Do you share sometimes that torn feeling? Son of St. Lucia in the West Indies, in the Caribbean, his poem Sea Grapes, which he reads himself here, is the title poem from a 1976 collection, same name, contrasts the longing for home with the need for adventure. And Walcott harkens back to classical Greek poets like Homer to show just how timeless this conflict is.
That sail which leans on light, tired of islands, a schooner beating up the Caribbean for home, could be Odysseus, homebound on the Aegean. That father and husband's longing under gnarled sour grapes is like the adulterer hearing Nausicaa's name in every gull's outcry. This brings nobody peace. The ancient war between obsession and responsibility will never finish, and has been the same for the sea wanderer or the one on shore, now wriggling on his sandals to walk home since Troy sighed its last flame, and the blind giant's boulder heave the trough from whose ground swell the great hexameters come to the conclusions of exhausted surf. The classics can console, but not enough.
The classics can console, but not enough. And yet, Adriana, he's so enamored of them. And you hear it here. You hear some in so much of his great work. What's the limit to the classics for this man?
I mean, I would say that what he's evoking here, right, the Odyssey and the Iliad is a lot about discovering yourself in this epic journey. And I think, you know, there aren't that many sea wanderers anymore. And so there's a certain kind of life and a certain epic heroic that the classics signal that I think are out of reach. And the classics, you know, are very much, you know, take place in, you know, Greece, in the cradle of civilization. And I think that Walcott is trying to move it to the Caribbean and try to start a new tradition, one that is a hybrid of both New World and Old.
But there's a limit to the consolation, Oskell.
Yes, yeah. And I think that's the tension in all his work, and that's what gives it its real sort of force and power. There is absolutely the joy, but that joy is reached, achieved only after a hard-won struggle. There is that ancient war between obsession and responsibility that is at the core of that poem. Mm-hmm. And that is
Go, stay,
fall in love. Mm-hmm. You know, the adulterers out, the adulterers cry. Mm-hmm. You know,
sick, be of this, flirt with that, love that.
You know, right.
Right. Say, it will never finish and has been the same for the sea wanderer and the one on shore.
And he sees that over and over, the kind of continuity and the recurrence of these eternal themes. And I think that that is what allowed him to redo Homer in St. Lucia.
In the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many callers. And right there from the Caribbean, Chaz in Miami. Mm. Chaz, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks so much. I could just turn on my radio and I'm hearing about my favorite poet. Next to me, on bedside reading for me is Seamus Heaney's Station Island and Derek Walcott's Homeros. My parents are from Cuba. And the times that I've been in the Caribbean, many times, there is a need for, I think, this expansive language, the way the light reflects off of water or refracts off of water, depending on the time of day. It is a Mare Nostrum, where all things happen, rivaling the Mediterranean in a lot of ways, going back to indigenous culture through the colonial era and the nationalist era.
Yeah.
It's the language of epic. That story of the Caribbean is very much rivals to a lot of people a Mediterranean-like classical feel.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Homeros is a work of art. I think it's one of the key works of the 20th century. When I was a student, a literature student, I referred to it time and time and time again. And it's influenced my own writing as a poet and a playwright.
I mean, this is sort of the Caribbean Odyssey. Chaz, I so appreciate your call right there from Miami. Adriana, for those who haven't read it, don't know it, describe what Derek Walcott did with Homeros, what the project
So in Homeros, he recasts the myth of the Odyssey and the tale of Odysseus as taking place in the Caribbean with fishermen. And it's really interesting because I actually read an interview that Walcott said he never finished reading the Odyssey. And yet he took it upon himself to rewrite it and reset it. But the Caribbean, I believe Chaz was saying, is such a wonderful place that lends itself to this kind of marvelous realism. You know, there's a reason Gabriel Garcia Marquez is also a Caribbean writer and that they, you know, there was an influence there on Walcott as well. And I fully agree that I think, you know, if the Odyssey were being written today, as it was in 1980 by Walcott, it would definitely take place in the Caribbean. There's so much magic and there's so many different ways to describe what the ocean does. I absolutely agree.
I want to hear the two of you read from your favorite poetry, this poetry we just want in our ears and our souls today. This window opens with a man's death, and it doesn't, just the way of the world, it doesn't stay open forever. There's The Prodigal, Adriana, and this is also about seeing the world in order to come home. Introduce us to, this is what, 500 pages. I hope you'll read something to us from it. Introduce us to The Prodigal, and then tell us what you've got to read.
So The Prodigal is a book-length poem. Walcott's brother died in the year 2000, I believe, and in 2004, he puts together this book, and it is so much thinking about, you know, death and the return home. There is a reason it is called The Prodigal, after all. Mm-hmm. And the selection that I picked is from section 15, number 1. As I said, it's one long poem, so different ones don't have titles. Mm-hmm. Old man coming through the glass, who are you? I am you. Learn to acknowledge me. The cottony white hair, the hair and shanks, and when you and your reflection bend, the leaf green eyes under the dented forehead, do you think time makes exceptions? Do you think death mutters, maybe I'll skip this one? the same silent consequence that crept across your brother perilously sleeping and all the others whose silence is no different from your brother's.
It's beautiful. And out of those 500 pages, why, how did you pick this passage?
Oh, I mean, I think given Walcott's passing, you know, he was also subject to the same silent consequence. But there's something beautiful about the idea of a consequence creeping, of taking an idea and, you know, making it manifest and tangible. And it's just so lovely. And it really makes me think about the way that all of our deaths can be interconnected into a much larger story.
The opening lines of that passage take me back to Love After Love, you know, where he said, the time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door and your own mirror. And here, old man, coming through the glass, who are you? I am you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that recognition of self and yet seeing the stranger in yourself as well, right? Like the passing of time. I certainly look in the mirror and I don't look 15 anymore.
Yeah.
And
yet,
you know,
it's you.
And yet it's still me and it's still the core person. And inside you feel the same, but your shell can be different and you're definitely a lot more worn by your life and what you've lived as well.
Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. Calls from Florida coming in today. Clearwater, Florida. Deborah, thank you for calling, Deborah. You're on the air with Adriana Ramirez and Oswald Melnichuk.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was delighted, shocked, and moved all at once in hearing this poet's words. I'd never heard of him or read any of his work, but it was only a few lines into the poem and I burst into tears. There is such a depth of exploring the self of the soul, maybe, something that is so deep that it's a core that he goes to and seems to live from. His issue of homeland versus adopted homeland is something that I strongly relate to. I came to Florida from Wisconsin to take care of my grandparents, developed a self-employment type of business, and now that my grandparents are gone, I'm here, and my clients won't move back to Wisconsin with me. So
there you are, Odysseus.
Yes.
I don't know if you're marooned or if you've arrived, or both.
Yes, exactly. And when I go back to Wisconsin to visit, I feel a physical pain upon leaving. And I just so relate it to the rich and vivid textures and truths in his poetry. This is an amazing revelation for me. I am so grateful. Thank you all.
Deborah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for calling. Oswald, tell us what you have to read. A Season of Phantasmal Peace. It's a marvelous thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that Deborah's response signals Derek's universality. While he's writing about such a specific place, the questions that he's asking about where is home, who am I, who am I young, who am I old,
his resonate with everyone. South, her Wisconsin is
That's
north,
right.
But the dynamic but there. Is there.
So this is, I think, one of the great poems in English literature.
Can you tell us a little bit about it, how you've come to know it?
It's one of the first poems of Walcott's that I am... came across. I met him in 82 and had heard that the kind of best conversation happening in town was taking place at 236 Bay State Road, where Derek was teaching at the time. And at that point, I had not known his work. And this was one of the first poems I kind of came upon.
The season of Phantasmal Peace.
Then all the nations of birds lifted together the huge net of the shadows of this earth in multitudinous dialects, twittering tongues, stitching and crossing it. They lifted up the shadows of long pines down trackless slopes, the shadows of glass-faced towers down evening streets, the shadow of a frail plant on a city sill, the net rising soundless as night, the birds' cries soundless, until there was no longer dusk or season, decline or weather, only this passage of phantasmal light that not the narrowest shadow dared to sever. And men could not see, looking up, what the wild geese drew, what the ospreys trailed behind them in silvery ropes that flashed in the icy sunlight. They could not hear battalions of starlings waging peaceful cries, bearing the net higher, covering this world like the vines of an orchard, or a mother drawing the trembling gauze over the trembling eyes of a child fluttering to sleep. It was the light that you will see at evening on the side of a hill in yellow October, and no one hearing knew what change had brought into the raven's cawing, the killdeer's screech, the ember-circling chuff, such an immense, soundless, and high concern for the fields and cities where the birds belong. Except it was their seasonal passing, love, made seasonless, or from the high privilege of their birth, something brighter than pity for the wingless ones below them, who shared dark holes in windows and in houses. And higher they lifted the net with soundless voices above all change, betrayals of falling suns. And this season lasted one moment, like the pause between dusk and darkness, between fury and peace. But for such as our earth is now, it lasted long.
Mm. Mm. Oswald Milichuk reading Derek Walcott's The Season of Phantasmal Peace. Wow. He creates a kind of sacred space there.
He manages to fix in language one of those great evanescent moments of transcendence that we all have flashes of, but which disappears. And we can now have it over and over. He recreates it for us, so it becomes like a kind of meditation. And I can't think of any poem that manages to create the sense of stasis in quite the same way. In that moment, that the complex image of the birds as they lift the shadows, the dynamism of the movement from the pines to the glass towers to something very small, the frail plant on the sill. Mm-hmm. The poem is just, it's like the camera zooming in, pulling out. It's a visionary poem, and we have very few visionaries in our language.
Adriana, is visionary still in style, or was he a kind of throwback in that way?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of has that tension to him because he's definitely evoking. This poem is written in blank verse, right? It's using pentameter. A loose pentameter. The rhyme isn't there, but it's definitely employing a lot of the structures that we would see in 19th and 20th century poetry. And yet thematically, his use of language, moments like, betrayals of falling suns, right? Or even the pause between fury and peace. They're very political and they're very much of their time. Mm-hmm. This poem was written, I believe, shortly after Bob Marley stopped making music. Mm-hmm. And it was right when the Cold War was starting to descend on the Caribbean. So there's a larger sense of the history that's happening and the larger shadows that are falling on the world. But there's also, this visionary call for peace. And this idea that birds, right, and birds who are the most international of animals, they fly everywhere, and they are everywhere, and they are the immigrants, I believe, of the animal kingdom. And it is the birds who are lifting up these shadows and allowing us this one perfect, quiet, yellow October moment. And I think it is visionary, even though it is evoking a lot of the styles and structures of the past. And I think that's what makes it kind of amazing, is that it's a combination of where we've been and where we're going.
We need this poetry. Derek Walcott brought it to us. Adriana Ramirez, Oskar Milnicek, please stand by. We will hear more. Listeners, you can join us this hour. We're listening to the poetry of Derek Walcott, died at 87 last year, Caribbean master, spanning so much. He wrote a musical with Paul Simon called The Cape Man. You can hear a little music from that behind us right here. We're looking at his poetry today. Do you have a favorite line, stanza of Walcott? Let's hear it. What's the poem you love and why? And are you just being snagged now by Derek Walcott, now that he's died? It's the way of the world. When we return, we go via telephone to his native St. Lucia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
Spanish eyes and soft brown curls. My love, come to me. I believe I'm in the power of St. Lazarus, and he holds me in his sight. I know that these jitterbug days I'm living, well, they won't last for all of us, but they'll last for a long summer night. satin summer skies.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry of Derek Walcott, a poetry of grandeur and exuberance from the Caribbean master who died last week at 87. Osgold Melnichuk is with us, novelist, essayist, poet, is an associate professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Knew Derek Walcott well, worked with him on literary magazine Agni during their time at Boston University. Adriana Ramirez joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Carlow University there, critic-at-large for the Los Angeles Times. She's written wonderfully about Walcott. You can link to her piece at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us in this hour. He was from St. Lucia. And Caribbean was elemental to his view of the world. Of course, it was much larger even than all that expanse. Caribbean Islanders, what did Derek Walcott mean to you? How did he span islands, Africa, English, the colonial, the anti-colonial? Is there something only you can hear in this poetry? Osgold, Adriana, please stand by. I want to go to St. Lucia right now, Castries, St. Lucia, and to Robert Lee, St. Lucian poet, literary critic, close friend of Derek Walcott. Robert Lee, thank you very much for joining us from the island today.
Hi, Tom. It's good to hear you. Good to be on the program this morning.
It's wonderful to have you.
Good morning, Robert.
Season of Phantasmal Peace.
Yes, good. How is Derek Walcott's passing being noted in St. Lucia, Robert?
Well, you know, we are a small island, 230 square miles, and Derek is almost a figure of national standing, national hero. Mm-hmm. So there is mourning. The government is going to give him what is called a state funeral on Saturday.
Mm. Wow.
Normally reserved for the governors general and the prime ministers. So he's getting all the works, military works and everything else.
Can imagine how he loved that.
On the Friday evening, there will be a cultural evening in which we have readings and remarks from not only local writers and people, but visiting people who we hope will be here, like his publisher and so on, out of New York.
You've said that
television programs covering all his earlier readings and lectures here.
Is as big as it gets, big as full honors there.
Indeed. He's big here, you know.
You've said that he taught you and other younger writers back in the day how to see your country, St. Lucia, with fresh eyes. What did he teach you to see?
Well, I think Derek taught me to see the landscape, the flowers, the trees, the mango leaves, and the animals running in the mud. And, of course, the sea, his beloved sea. He lived, his house was on the very edge of the ocean. And I think as I read Derek, I was able myself to see my island, as it were, with fresh eyes through his eyes, but also to begin to interpret for myself what I was seeing in my own words, my own language, my own images. But I think he is the master for me. What I've learned from many other writers, contemporary and, of course, older writers, I think Derek Walcott taught me, and he absorbed to me in himself all of the past and the best of the contemporary, including American writers. And I learned that from him. So I sat at his feet as a student and learned, and hopefully I tried in my own poetry to capture some of that. But he taught me to see, yes, St. Lucia, the Caribbean, and indeed the world.
He was gone for so long. He spent decades abroad. He was a wanderer in that way. Was he always seen as a homeboy, as St. Lucia's, or was he seen as someone who left and sort of abandoned the island?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. Even though he lived abroad, mm-hmm. he lived in the States for many years, as you know, mm-hmm. but he visited home often. He was always home. Mm-hmm. Every year he came for holidays. Mm-hmm. And, of course, soon after the Nobel Prize, he built his own house here. So, really, he wasn't that distant. And the Walcott family, his mother, his brother, his twin brother, who was also a playwright who died in 2000, these were well-known people in the small community of St. Lucia, certainly Castries, from which I'm speaking to you now, his home city. So the Walcotts were well-known. He was always seen as a homeboy. As I say, while Derek was away working and getting his prizes, his name was always with us, and I say he did visit very often. So it was never a long-distance relationship. And myself and younger writers always had his company when he came. He'd invite us over, look out for us. And in recent years, always invited us to his home to meet people like Melissa Green, who's from Massachusetts, fine poet, Arthur Miller, whom I got to interview at some point, Seamus Heaney. So he always reached out to us and brought us in and taught us very indirectly, you know?
Yes.
He would listen to our work and advise us, but never in an imposing way, never at all.
Fantastic. Robert Lee, stand by on St. Lucia. Lots of callers. Karen in Madison, Wisconsin. Karen, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you know of Derek Walcott?
The one poem that you read this morning about peeling yourself off the mirror. But what I wanted to say was what I am struck with in his poetry is there's, and maybe you've talked about it, but there's a great deep sense of spirituality or universality in his poetry, and that he's saying, and I must think that many people don't want to talk about that, you know, that, but I think he's saying that just in being in the moment, seeing the birds, being in nature itself, it's a spiritual, for lack of better words, experience, or and like when he says the space between peace, violence and peace is that space in between when you're just being. And everything, I mean, just the beauty of nature and how nature brings us into the present moment, puts us in our place because we are not huge and powerful. We are small and just part of a greater whole. And also the truth of, you know, we search all our life for what we have, which is the richness of our inner selves that even Carl Jung talked about, you know, that the universe within is as vast and expansive as the universe without, and we're always looking outward. And so I think that's really what I was always struck with his poetry, is that sense of just being. You are rich right now as yourself. You have everything you need. And again, I don't know him really well, I guess if I'm wrong, I'd have you speak to that.
Let us dive in. You've got Oskold Melnichuk nodding vigorously here. You're still, as many callers, thinking about the first poem, Love After Love. Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life. Oskold?
But she's also thinking about those birds lifting the net and letting the light in. And so I think that Walcott was a spiritual poet. He was also a political poet, many things to talk about. But that he had that sense of the transcendent, which was imminent in the natural world. I mean, he saw the glory of eternity in the moment indeed. And one line, there's one poem in The Prodigal, or one stanza in The Prodigal I'd like to read that I think...
Yes, please.
Reinforces, or actually it is where I think Derek resolves that tension between his many homes. Here he is walking through the streets of Europe, walking down a fabulous Via Veneto in Rome, and what he's remembering is this. I lived in two villages, Greenwich and Grow Islet, and loved both almost equally. One had the sea, gray morning light along the walking water. The other, a great river. And if they asked what country I was from, I'd say, the light of that tree-lined sunrise down the Via Veneto. It was in the light that he found himself at home everywhere.
Beautiful. Again, though, as you say, he was political as well. Here's some stanzas from Derek Walcott's poem, Ruins of a Great House. He's describing his frustration and anger with how African slaves in the Caribbean were treated during the 18th and 19th centuries, uses fruits and leprosy as a metaphor for the fall of the British Empire.
The smell of dead limes quickens in the nose, the leprosy of empire. Farewell, green fields. Farewell, ye happy groves. Marble like Greece, like Faulkner's south in stone. Deciduous beauty prospered and is gone. but where the lawn breaks in a rash of trees, a spade below dead leaves will ring the bone of some dead animal or human thing fallen from evil days, from evil times. It seems that the original crops were limes grown in the silt that clogs the river's skirt. The imperious rakes are gone, their bright girls gone. The river flows, obliterating hurt. I climbed a wall with the grill ironwork of exiled craftsmen, protecting that great house from guilt, perhaps, but not from the worm's rent, nor from the padded cavalry of the mouse. And when a wind shook in the limes, I heard what Kipling heard, the death of a great empire, the abuse of ignorance by Bible and by sword.
Dirk Walcott, reading from his own Ruins of a Great House. Adriana Ramirez, your family came from Colombia. You know something of this realm. What about the politics of Dirk Walcott? It wasn't all transcendent beauty and insight.
Oh, no. I mean, I would say that tucked into that transcendent beauty and insight, there's definitely some sharpness. There's some teeth. I mean, the death of a great empire, the abuse of ignorance by Bible and by sword, right?
I mean, leprosy of empire, even.
Oh, yes, sorry, I have a different translation or a different version in front of me. But yeah, the abuse of ignorance by Bible and by sword gets to the heart of colonialism, I think, the whole gold, God, and glory thing. And I mean, the beauty that he saw was also a beauty that was wrought by larger colonial influences. You can't escape that. You know, Colombia is a Caribbean country as well, sort of, I guess, the coast. And, you know, going through Cartagena or a city like that, you can see the juxtaposition of natural beauty with empire and with conquest. And, you know, there's always the struggle of what you are if you have the skin and the blood of both conqueror and conquered. And there's always going to be a tension there. So I don't think he can escape it.
Which he did, Skoll. I mean, he was of African descent, but also European descent. Could you feel that? And did he articulate?
He did, constantly. He was always very self-aware of the history that he carried in his body, and it made him curious about the history that you carried. So he was always curious to get into where your family was from.
What makes you up.
That's right. And that was very much coming from his own sort of self-awareness. That sense of self-division is a constant theme in the poems. But as I said, he did find a way to resolve that tension for himself. He was one of the first poets I know who spoke about empire. And he made it a real point to tell in almost all the conversations I had with him, to ask Americans to remember that we are an empire and we are an empire of outrageous.
He spoke of American empire early on.
And, you know, he spoke about the outrageous privilege that we enjoy that leaves us often oblivious, indifferent. You know, we in this very big island have in fact, erected metaphoric walls for a long time. And he and Seamus and Brodsky were all here partly to tear them down so that we could peer over our own walls and see what was happening.
Anita is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Walcott here at in Norfolk at Old Dominion University. I am from St. Vincent, which is a stone's throw away from St. Lucia. So I grew up with Dirk Walcott's work. I appreciated him. He was such a visionary in his work, and I never had the opportunity to meet him in the Caribbean, but I did have the opportunity to meet him here and hear him read his own work. He'll be missed.
Yeah, Anita, also from St. Lucia. Robert Lee, in St. Lucia, what about this man's politics? Are they remembered along with his Nobel Prize and glory?
Indeed. Derek was also very concerned about, if we want to call it environmental politics. You know, St. Lucia, like many of the islands of the Caribbean, are heavily dependent on tourism. So even if you look at White Egrets, the poems where he speaks about, you know, the new hotels coming up, a place where he'd go to park and write and paint, and then there were people out measuring the land to build hotels. And he has made his voice very strongly heard on environmental issues, development projects which are happening right now in St. Lucia, which hurt the environment, which are being done without any real care for the landscape, even for the concerns of the people. And Derek very clearly spoke out, even against, you know, the politicians of the day, as to what he felt about it. So definitely, as somebody said a while ago, there was a sharp edge, not just the transcendent, very true, and the love of nature and the spiritual sense he had. But he was very sharp, not only in terms of the anti-colonialism stance from his generation, but the fresher issues in terms of the politics of the day and environmental issues as they came up. He was not afraid to speak out against them. And, of course, for the politics, if you want, of art and how the government never really supported artists and writers and painters as they ought to. So he was never afraid to speak out. It certainly was a sharp edge to him.
Adriana, our time grows so short, but I want to hear a little more of the man's poetry while we may. I don't know if we can read all of this, what you have from White Egrets in the Village, but begin it for us. Read us at least half of that.
Yeah. From In the Village, number 3. Who has removed the typewriter from my desk so that I am a musician without his piano, with emptiness ahead as clear and grotesque as another spring? My veins bud, and I am so full of poems, a wastebasket of black wire. The notes outside are visible. The sparrows will lie in antennae like staves, the way springs were. But the roofs are cold, and the great gray river, where a liner glides, huge as a winter hill, moves imperceptibly like the accumulating years.
We're good. Go on.
I have no reason to forgive her for what I have brought on myself. I am past hating, past the longing for Italy, where blowing snow absolves and whitens a kneeling mountain range outside Milan. Through glass, I am waiting for the sound of a bird to unhinge the beginning of spring. But my hands, my work, feel strange without the rusty music of my machine. No words for the Arctic liner moving down the Hudson, for the mange of old snow molting from the roofs. No poems, no birds.
From all his work, that passage jumped out to you. Why, Adriana?
Oh, because what is an artist without the ability to make art? And I just think there's something so beautiful about, you know, there are so many poems in me. I'm full of them, a wastebasket of black wire. And, you know, that you need your tools to make. And without that, there are no birds, right? Mm-hmm. Which ultimately is the metaphor he comes back to again and again. There isn't that freedom of flight without the ability to make poetry.
Oscar, we have half a minute. Last thought for Derek Walcott.
So we've spoken about him in appropriately high terms. I'd also want to point out that he was a very irreverent man who loved the joke. And there was nothing funnier than listening to him and Heaney and Brodsky exchange humor, their own kind of local native humor. And if I might just read last couple lines
very
of his poem called Sea Canes. The sea canes by the cliff flash green and silver. They were the seraph lances of my faith, but out of what is lost grows something stronger that has the rational radiance of stone, enduring moonlight further than despair, strong as the wind through the dividing canes, brings those we love before us as they were, with faults and all, not nobler, just there.
From Derek Walcott, our great thanks to all of you. Robert Lee on St. Lucia today. Adriana Ramirez in Pittsburgh. Oskold Melnichuk with me here in the studio. Wonderful to remember. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.